You're listening to Dr. Finn Pollard and colleagues on Siren FM with Past Prologue.
The word is about, there's something evolving. Whatever may come, the world keeps revolving. They say the next big thing is here, that the revolution's near. But to me it seems quite clear that it's all just a little bit of history repeating.
It's Medieval Week, Finn. Medieval Week. Are we not excited?
We are very excited.
Past Prologue actually taking place in Medieval Week with Christian maps and Jewish monsters. I've got my ticket here amongst our person. I'm showing it. She'll be there. It's going to be outstanding. And we've got an outstanding programme today. Would you like to just briefly tease ahead before we go to the Bonzo Dog Band?
We do. We have pried them away from medieval tile making and virtual blacksmithing. So we're very pleased to have with us Asa Mittman from California State, and from here at home, Renee Ward from the School of English and Journalism and Andrew Elliott from the School of Film and Media. Monster Mash. I'm sorely tempted to say we just carry on and segue into the intro and the outro. We better not. And there is a clue to our, or part of our topic this time in the number there, because Asa Mittman, who we're going to speak to first of all, is a scholar of monsters and monster studies. And I wonder whether you could say a little bit more about what that entails first off.
Sure, I'd be happy to. And thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. Monster studies is, like all academic studies, something that we just made up and doesn't really exist in a sense. But that's actually true of absolutely all studies, including the study of literature or history or postcolonial studies or gender studies or whatever studies you like. It isn't to say the subject isn't there, but that when we study it as an academic discipline, that's an artificial construct that we came up with. When I started working on monsters, which was almost 20 years ago, there were just a couple of scattered bits and pieces on the subject. There was a good book here and a good article there, but there was no collective conversation. And so when I would tell people, you know, this, when you're in your dissertating phase, you know, say, oh, well, what are you writing about? And I'd say, oh, I'm writing about monsters. And people would always laugh, actually. And it took me a long time to get to find a way to say that that somehow didn't sound like a punchline, which I never intended it to be. It wasn't. It really was what I was doing. For that reason, one of the things I put a lot of effort into was trying to create a community of people working on the subject. And that's when you go from, oh, yeah, I'm writing about, you know, this medieval text that has monsters in it, these medieval images that have monsters in it, what have you, to having something that we could think of as being such and such studies. That's the difference to me anyway, is if you have a whole bunch of people who can get together at conferences, who can do panels, who can do symposia, who can have edited collections and special journal issues, then you have a field. And so that's where we are now, I would say, with monster studies. There is one. There's an actual field. It's a lot of fun, actually.
So can I ask you, can you give me a specific example of the kind of thing this led you into, the sort of, I mean, I'm thinking, sort of, what sort of monsters are we talking about? Where were you finding them?
Sure. When I first got into it, I started by working on maps. And I was really interested in this map called the Hereford Map, the Mappa Mundi. It's probably the most famous surviving medieval world map. It's the biggest one that survives about 5 feet high. And it's been in Hereford for about 700 years, give or take. And I was very interested. I was looking at England on it, and I was looking at the sort of territory around England. And what I kept finding were all of these wonderful monsters on it. And I started getting interested in them sort of on their own, and then finding those same creatures appearing in other texts. So I started tracing them to sort of their origin, their medieval origin, sometimes then back to ancient origins behind that. But the ones that were most interesting to me then, and probably are still the most interesting to me, are the kind of human-ish ones. So dragons are great and all that, but I'm much more interested in the ones that are closer to us, because that gives them a little more intellectual tooth, I think, for us. It gives us something with which to really compare ourselves. So there's a particular set of monsters. They used to be called the monstrous races. I've kind of argued against using that term for them, call them monstrous peoples or something now. But that's been around for a long time. They travel around, they show up in a lot of places. They're on the Hereford map and a bunch of other maps, but they also show up in their own batches of texts called the Wonders of the East or the Marvels of the East. And they are creatures like the Blemmy, who is 8 feet tall and has no head, and the Cynocephalus, who's a dog-headed, sometimes fire-breathing, sometimes person-eating giant, and the Skiopod, who has one giant foot on which he runs very swiftly and with which he shields himself from the hot African sun. And so this sort of stock set of characters shows up often collectively, but also just individually, absolutely everywhere. There are some in the cathedral next door. They are in every kind of manuscript that you could look for. They're on lots and lots of the maps. So the more you become aware of them, the more you find them just absolutely everywhere.
And can you say anything about why they're being deployed in this way? What are the, I mean, is it? I mean, I'm sort of having images on the maps of sort of fearful, unknown places that are signified by monsters. But that may just be my sort of pop culture sense, rather than any. Well, of course, it is, rather than any sort of knowledge of the historical context.
Sure, yeah. You know, the old line that we all imagine that's on medieval maps, here there be dragons, survives literally on only one medieval map. But lots and lots of maps do have dragons off in the edges, and here there be other things. The earliest map of the world that survives from the West, really, is this thing called the Cotton Map, or the Anglo-Saxon World Map in the British Library. It's got Hic sunt leones, here there be lions, in Asia, in northwestern Asia, for some reason. That's where the lions are on that. But they're just as wondrous as any, you know, I mean, a gigantic cat is as marvelous as a gigantic lizard, isn't it? If you're living in England, both are pretty foreign. So what are they doing there? To a degree, yes, I think they're sort of policing the boundaries of the world that out there are monstrous things. But if you start looking at them sort of specifically, they often are setting up a kind of anti-type. And one of the reasons I think they appear collectively is when you look at a whole run of these monstrous peoples, what you're doing is constructing a normative person through inversion. And so it takes a lot of them. You have to have a variety of different types of bodies that are not, quote unquote, us in order to figure out what we are. You have a variety of strange diets in order to determine what our correct diet is. You have a bunch of lifestyles, family organizations, marriage rites and rituals, hunting practices, kingship structures, all of these kinds of things that comprise sort of the mainstay of medieval life, or really life in most periods. These are shown to us in antitype and inversion through a variety of these monsters. And so if you want to know what a culture thinks is central and important, correct, proper, what you do is look at the monsters and then flip them. And so by placing them often at a geographical remove, I mean, first off, then you don't have to argue that there are people with no heads next door, which is a hard fiction to maintain. But also, you put them on the other side, right? You put them far out there, and then they can be this sort of inverted us. One of the sort of fun creatures that you'll see on a lot of the maps are these people called the antipodes, right, or antipodes. Antipodes, I think some people say over here. But anti against podes, feet. So they're the people whose feet are opposite ours. And so on the other side of the globe, so medieval, I don't know about, Joe the Plowman, but medieval thinkers, theologians, and geographers, cartographers know the world is spherical. Right, so they'll do these images of a spherical world where there are people on the opposite side whose feet face us, right? And so they become, in a sense, sort of a metonym for all of these. These are all the people who are, opposed to us, but by being anti, right? They're opposed. They're not just people who are over there, but people whose feet are opposite ours. But then they also get represented sometimes with their feet twisted around backward, and walking the opposite direction that their faces face, which, is another way of sort of making peoples far away sort of ridiculous, right? This is obviously not just variation. This is a less useful way for a human being to be built, to not be able to see where you're going. And so if we think about what that would mean in terms of coming across other groups of people, to view them as people who have no idea where they're going and what they're doing. It's fun to have these sort of in fantasy, but they start to matter when you start actually dealing with people who are not from your home culture.
The They're lining up the prisoners and the guards are taking aim. I struggled with some demons. They were middle class and tame. I didn't know I had permission to murder and to maim. You want it darker? Hey, nay, 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 I'm ready, my lord. Magnified, sanctified be the holy name. Vilified, crucified in the human frame. A million candles burning for the love that never came. You want it darker? We kill the flame. If you are the dealer, let me out of the game. If you are the healer, I'm broken and lame. If thine is the glory, mine must be the shame. You want it darker? Hey, nay, nay.
Leonard Cohen with You Want It Darker. I want to stay with Asa just for a little bit longer before bringing the others in, and I want to come on a minute to asking you about how thinking about monsters has led you into thinking about some more contemporary issues. But I just wanted to pick up on one thing that was interesting me from what you were saying before we played the Cohen. Presumably, a lot of these constructions on the maps and the other sources are being undertaken by the literate section of the population. Do we know anything about how this kind of filters down to the rest of other people?
Mm. Oh, that's a great question. I mean, one of the troubles of studying the Middle Ages is the records, of course, come down to us from the very small portion of the population that's literate. In early Anglo-Saxon England, something like 3 to 5% of the population is literate. I mean, it steadily builds up through the Middle Ages, and then you get the printing press, and it kind of explodes. But so we don't have, you know, a lot of sort of firsthand accounts from average parishioners or something. But one thing we could think about is who had access to what. So, for example, one of the wonderful maps that have a bunch of these is the Psalter map, which is in the British Library. And that was almost certainly produced for English royalty. And so that would have been accessible to the king, his immediate family, his retinue, that kind of thing. It's in a Psalter, so a prayer book. Okay, and that map is the actual circle of the earth there is about 3 inches across. I mean, a tiny, tiny little gem of a thing. On the other hand, the Hereford map seems to have hung on the wall of the side aisle of the cathedral and probably as part of a pilgrimage route to the shrine of the, now sainted. Then they were trying to get sainted, Bishop Thomas Cantilupe. And so there were thousands of pilgrims who visited this site and presumably walked along this map as part of that voyage. And so in that case, a great number of people would have seen it. Now, what would they have made of it? The text on the map, there's 1,091 inscriptions on that map, mostly in Latin. That's in Latin in the map. And then sort of around the frame of it are Norman French texts. So how many people walking by would have been able to read those? Well, not very many. And how many would have taken the time to read them as well? They're very small, and it's a giant thing, so probably, again, not very many. But some good scholars have theorized that there may well have been sort of blue badge guides at the time who would have walked some people through what was going on there. Well, over here you have this, and over here you have this. And there are even some scratches on the map that some have theorized may have been sort of overzealous pointing by these guides. Particularly, Paris is sort of badly abused on the map. And, you know, some people think that might have been Hundreds Years' War and other such, you know, sort of political conflicts, but it may also have just have been people saying, and here's Paris, poke, 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 here's Paris. And so I think for some of these objects, we can say they were only available to either a royal audience or a monastic audience. But for others, we can say with pretty good sense of assurity that many, many people saw them. That's not the same thing as many people paid a great deal of attention to them or knew what to make of them, but yes, would have seen them.
I love this idea of medieval blue guides, and I when also a sort of image of something like Paris, of them also using it as an opportunity to kind of whip up a certain idea of the other in the people they're taking around. I think it's a very vivid thought. But moving up a bit to the present day, mm-hmm. You were saying before we started communicating by email that it's this study of monsters has led you into thinking about a number of quite challenging contemporary issues, like, for example, anti-Semitism. And I wondered if you could say a bit about how that's come to be the case.
Sure, I can. When I started on Monsters, predominantly it was good fun. You know, I was very excited by all the sort of wonderful, strange beings at the other end of the world and so on. You know, and these, you know, headless giants are fantastic things, you know. But if we pause for a minute and realize that all of those beings that I mentioned, the Blemmies and Skiapods and Cynocephali and so on, are presented to us as the actual inhabitants of Asia or North Africa. They move around a lot. What that does is it sets up Europeans to presume that the inhabitants of those regions are not quite human. One of the most prominent manuscripts or texts that contains a lot of these stories is a thing called the Book of John Mandeville. Which was probably the most popular secular work of the Middle Ages. It survives in 300 manuscripts in 9 medieval languages. I mean, just to put it in context, you know, Beowulf survives in 1. There are over 3,500 books that have been written about Beowulf. So the obsession about it is at least partly modern. We are very excited about it. They don't seem to have liked it nearly as much as the Book of John Mandeville. And John Mandeville travels all around the world, and he goes to the East, and he meets and sees all of these various kinds of people. That book was Columbus's bedside reading on the voyage across the Atlantic. And so when he arrived in what he thought was the Indies, he tells us there were one-eyed, dog-headed, giant cannibals on the island of Bohio. And then he began a genocide. So the good fun kind of evaporates out of a lot of this material, leaves you with a kind of dust in the mouth feeling, when we bear in mind the horrifying consequences a lot of this stuff had and continues to have. And some of my more recent work for the last few years, I've turned to writing about medieval representations, medieval Christian representations of Jews, which are often predicated on the same kinds of dehumanizing, demonizing, othering tropes that were long in existence already for dealing with these other kinds of marginalized and exoticized peoples. So to, say, medieval English Christians, Jews were an exotic Eastern group, just like Blemmies and Cynocephali were. They were a strange group with unusual, just like I was talking about before, unusual dietary habits, unusual methods of dress, unusual religious practices. These are all of the same kinds of things that we read about in regard to these purely fantastic beings. But when the beings in question are real humans that are presented through those same tropes, the consequences are absolutely predictable. So that that's sort of the turn my scholarship has taken fairly recently, and I'm trying to write a book on representations of Jews on medieval Christian maps to tie these things all together. They've been occasionally observed, but never really focused on. There's no study of any kind that pulls them all together, and there are actually quite a few, I think, really powerful and important and problematic images of Jews that appear on a whole range of medieval maps.
And do these sort of representations have links to similar manifestations in the present day, do you think? Are people using depictions of monsters in sort of similar ways now?
I wish I could say, oh, no, this stuff's ancient history. I don't have to worry about that. But very much so. Very much so. This all kind of came clear to me. This was several years ago, 7 or 8 years ago. I was teaching a course, and we just made it through a long section on monsters. And we were talking about all these kinds of monsters we've been talking about just now. And then the course turned to images of Jews. And we had on the screen this image from the Winchester Psalter, which is a very famous manuscript. It's in all the big art history survey textbooks and so on. But they tend to show not the virulently anti-Semitic imagery. And there's an image of the arrest of Christ, and it's the start of the Passion sequence. And the gospel texts say that it's a group of Roman soldiers and Jewish temple police, depending on which gospel you're reading at that moment, who are the ones who come and arrest Christ. And in the image, what you see is a really appalling series of grotesque, stereotyped, supposedly Jewish figures. And one of them has big razor-like fangs filling his mouth. They're all sort of bulbous-headed and bug-eyed, and of course all have giant hooked or bulbous noses of various kinds. They're wielding sort of savage weapons. One's holding a gigantic bone with a spike sticking out of it and so on. And they're really an appalling lot of absolutely demonized and dehumanized figures. And I had this up on the screen, and we'd been through a few weeks of looking at medieval monsters, and I thought sort of the context was all set for a thoughtful discussion about this. And there was a woman in the class who, frankly, had been looking kind of angry all semester, but was looking angrier and angrier throughout my sort of introduction to this image. And finally, she just burst out without being called on or any such thing. She stood up and she yelled at me and she said, "I don't see what you're trying to get at." I thought, "I'm not trying to get at anything. I'm explaining to you history, you know." And she said, "Because first off, that is what Jews look like. And anyway, they killed Jesus." To be clear, this isn't the sort of thing that happens often in my teaching. This was a fairly anomalous event, although I come across all kinds of sort of passive, ill-thought, accidental forms of anti-Semitism constantly that are really rooted just on not having ever thought about it, no idea what they're actually saying, just sort of general ignorance, which is it's not great, but it's certainly lacks any kind of edge or animosity, whereas this was very severe and extreme, and she started screaming and shouting in the class. And, you know, I was horrified, but thinking back on it, I mean, I couldn't have done better if I had planted her there, because I'd been trying to convince my students, sort of to your point, that this stuff is not over. This is a very present and prevalent concern. And when she burst out like this, all the other students in the class were horrified and stared at her with their eyes wide and their mouths hanging open and they were all struck speechless. And I didn't then have to argue that, yes, this stuff carries on. But that was a while ago, and frankly, things have gotten a lot worse. At least, you know, for those of us over on the other side of the pond, the recent turn in politics, the election of Donald Trump, who ran on an openly racist and xenophobic campaign, who directly and without any pretense spoke in all kinds of demonizing ways about various groups of people. That was sort of the first main, call to action. And then we had Charlottesville, which I assume was all over the news over here as it was over there, yep. Which was a thing called the Unite the Right rally, in which a group of so-called alt-right, a.k.a. white supremacists, white nationalists, and neo-Nazis, gathered and got torches and marched through the streets of Charlottesville chanting Nazi-era slogans like blood and soil and Jews will not replace us. Yes, we all know anti-Semitism is still around. Yes, we all know that other forms of racism are still around. And those groups who were there certainly have a kind of cathexis, a sort of obsessive fixation with Jews, but equally so are deeply prejudiced against all kinds of groups, probably most notably African Americans, Muslims, and probably also people of Central and South American descent.
Ofra Haza, Im Non Alu, I think. I've scribbled it down. I can't read my own handwriting, so it's all going well. I want to take a moment here to bring Andy in. And I thought it would be interesting, first of all, to ask you, obviously you work on, have tended to work on material that's a bit nearer to
our own time. And to what extent do monsters, do we see similar monsters cropping up in the kind of material you work in?
Yes, it's been really fascinating hearing Asa identifying kind of the place of the monsters and the monstrous in the Middle Ages, because some of those things that he's bringing up are very, very familiar to the material that we see, the, you know, the material reuse of the Middle Ages in modern political discourse. I think chiefly you can kind of group those loosely into kind of the overt and the covert kind of uses of the monstrous. So things like... you know, the grotesque imagery of the you know, the classic stereotypical anti-Semitic image of the Jew, right? You can see this not only continuing in this very sort of linear pathway through things like, you know, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion and the accompanying images and so on, and that translates directly into a sort of internet networked era, into images like memes that can be easily cut and pasted, mm-hmm. and that's in fact the function of them, to be cut and pasted. So certainly in the social media groups that I've looked at, particularly of the far right, you will see anti-Semitic images occurring, this monsters being used. It's very, very prevalent in Islamophobic rhetoric as well, to show the, you know, the image of, there's a very, very popular one with some of the far-right groups here in the UK, where it's a sort of a sequential cartoon where they rip the burqa off a Muslim woman and it's actually a monster underneath, you know, sort of what are they hiding is the argument. But it also takes place, I think, and perhaps more powerfully, because certainly the overt ones you can immediately reject as kind of off the scale, and I was going to say off the map, but actually the covert point is just as powerful, which is where we locate this kind of monstrous in a perhaps more figurative sense, but certainly the division of the world into the civilized and the non-civilized, the them and the us, that has been placed into a kind of translated into a geopolitical project. When we see people saying, you know, that certain places are S-hole nations, right, which is, we sort of mentioned this before, but also when we see that places like Afghanistan are described as medieval, right, what we're doing is we're locating these other places in, not only in a place of time, which we're saying is implicitly barbaric, but also we're I think kind of geographically mapping the monstrous politics in exactly the same way as Asa was talking about we did in the Middle Ages.
Yes, and you were querying with me before we started about whether this, you were mentioning the fact there's a kind of project currently to describe the Middle Ages as being the in Europe as being the cradle of a particularly sort of white civilization, and wondering whether there's a link with that to the way monsters are being used.
Oh, yeah, I think unquestionably there's a very strong link. I mean, the Middle Ages were, as a lot of wonderful recent scholarship has shown, a much more diverse place than modern kind of myth would have it, as the Roman world was, as every period really has been. But the Middle Ages becomes a kind of fantasy of a kind of pure whiteness. And the use by far-right groups of medieval material shows, I mean, the link is very direct. I was looking, there was an episode, so we're here in Lincoln, which is, you know, the seat of one of the sort of great moments of anti-Jewish defamation in English history, the myth of Little St. Hugh, who is one of the blood libel tales, supposedly murdered and tortured and murdered by a conspiracy of Jews who have gathered from all over England and so on and so on. It's a pretty common model that starts in Norwich and travels around. I think Lincoln's is about the sixth or seventh such instance, but it's one of the more prominent ones. Gets the attention of the king, who sponsored that memorial that's been taken down. But yes, it shows up in Chaucer's The Prioress's Tale at the end, to kind of lend credence to the virulently anti-Semitic tale that he provides there, which is the same story again and again and again. These, like memes, right? It's sort of like a medieval meme. It's this cut-and-paste story, yeah. Oh, the invidious Jews who... so on, so on. But a group of far-right white supremacists came to Lincoln to celebrate St. Hugh a few years ago. And they wrote it up, and it's all still online. And what they said was, well, if you read your Matthew Paris, you'll find, and Matthew Paris is the same source I'm reading to talk about the medieval anti-Semitic practices and the ways that these myths are generated and developed, but they are pointing to it as straight up, straightforward accounts of history. Well, as Matthew Paris says, Jews, you know, crucify Christian boys and use their blood to make Passover matzah. Just to be clear, they didn't. But yeah, there's a very straight line between these medieval anti-Semitic tropes and modern medievalist anti-Semitism. And one of the things that I do think is really important for medievalists, a lot of us had not thought a great deal about any of this. You know, we're just going about our business. We're loving our subject. Oh, yes, I'm a medievalist. I work on this. I work on that. Without realizing the territory that we were sharing with some pretty horrifying people. And I think that it is really incumbent on all of us in the field now to be very clear that we don't share ethical, moral, or intellectual ground with people who are trying to hijack the study of the Middle Ages for their own, prejudicial modern purposes.
Sure. I mean, that was going to be my kind of next question. Is there a way, what sort of ways do you think there are that the, as it were, the scholarly community of medievalists can effectively combat some of the way this material is being appropriated? Because at first glance, one sort of thinks of the two groups as being in quite different worlds and being used to quite different modes of communication. And bridging across that is presumably quite challenging.
Yeah, yes, but we have to do it anyway, I think. First and foremost, we have our own students. And I would love to think that none of my students are already in the other camp. First off, I don't know that to be true. Second, I do know in a couple of cases they clearly are, as in the instance I cited. But I would say the bulk of them are not fully formed in their thinking about any of this and are probably reading all kinds of God knows what online. And I now actively refuse to allow that perspective to passively kind of creep in around the edges when I'm teaching. When people asked my field, I used to say, oh, I'm an Anglo-Saxonist, but that was without any consciousness, really. I wasn't thinking through the fact that for the vast majority, at least, of Americans, Anglo-Saxonist does not mean a specialist in the history, literature, and art of England from, you know, the end of the Roman period to the Norman conquest. It actually means basically Nazi. And so people who are calling themselves Anglo-Saxonists in the U.S., there's like six of me and my friends who are academics who study the field. But now I wonder how many times I had, you know, some student out there in the class who heard me say, hi, I'd like to welcome you to my class. My name's Asa Mittman. I'm an Anglo-Saxonist, who heard something profoundly different than what I meant. So I will now be much more overt in talking about these issues, in raising them, in engaging them head on. So that's number one, our students. Number two is our scholarship, which granted, I mean, you know, it has a relatively constrained audience. If I write a book on Anglo-Saxon manuscripts or, you know, medieval maps or something like that, I know that it's not going to be read by tens of thousands out there. But that raises a third thing, which is public scholarship, which is something I think we should be engaging in much more vigorously and more regularly. And I would say those of us who are fortunate enough to be in positions of relative authority, I'm the head of my department, which means I have some say over hiring and also of our tenure and promotion processes. I think it's incumbent on those of us with those kinds of responsibilities to be active in soliciting and welcoming and rewarding the kind of public scholarship that often has been considered not the real thing, not the serious thing. You know, if you get your article into a journal read by 12 people, that is what counts. And if you get your thing into a, I don't know, a major newspaper, which might be read by 100,000 people, no, that's not real, you know. So I think we've got to work on that to get people to get these ideas and the scholarship out to a much broader public.
The There's been some really great stuff happening online. I mean, the community and the way they've been handling this, I'm thinking of there's a place or an online site called The Public Medievalist, and they've been running for the past year now, they've been running a series on race in the Middle Ages, and each, you know, each installment focuses on different aspects of race or different groups and different problems, the usurpation by white supremacist groups. There's also been this fabulous resource put together in one of the online communities on Facebook that's a massive ongoing bibliography for people so people like us to share the text that we've come across that help us study race in the Middle Ages, and then for it to kind of keep going, right? It's a public resource. So I think those types of things have been the really positive end result of some of this, is that community has come together to address some of these things and to share resources, which can only improve the working environment and the teaching environment.
Absolutely. And if I may, I just received by chance this morning an invitation to collaborate on an article for a collection on how to teach this material. Because a lot of folks say, oh, I'd love to do that, but I'm not an expert in X or Y. You know, I really work on, you know, 12th century ecclesiastical reform movements. How could I possibly speak about anti-Semitism or Islamophobia or so on? And the answer is, you don't have that luxury anymore. You have to. So I think it's great that people are trying to put together some resources to help people figure out how to do that, find a voice in this.
I agree that the public scholarship is quite an important angle. Certainly, it's really tempting to be quite despondent about that. That, you know, things like articles being hidden behind paywalls and kind of a policy of not anti-experts, kind of popular movements. But actually, the more and more of us that are finding that we're speaking in popular and public domains, we're finding actually huge responses. And it's a great way to combat these very powerful myths of belonging.
Vogue, I Want a Monster to Be My Friend, lightening the mood, perhaps a little bit. And I thought perhaps for the last section of today's Past Prologue, I was wrestling as we were thinking about these very dark ways in which medieval monsters can be used and these very dark themes. I was beginning to think, well, because we started off with a much more sort of fun vision of monsters, and whether how these two things can coexist, whether it's still possible for monsters to be fun. And I was also thinking about the way that we had talked quite a lot about some of the reactions and tensions and issues that arise on US campuses. And I thought it would be interesting perhaps to bring either Renee or Andy in terms of how they might have been teaching some of this stuff here in Lincoln. So I think, Renee, you had some thoughts.
I've been teaching a module on British medieval literature, and we've certainly covered quite a few of the texts that Asa has actually talked about. We started with John Mandeville. We've been reading Chaucer's The Prioress's Tale. So we've certainly been exploring these tensions and thinking about racial differences and cultural differences, but we've also looked at some of Henryson's beast fables, for instance, which are some of them are quite comical. So it's this idea of, you know, we are unfortunately using the animal as kind of the parable for ourselves. But one of the things we did yesterday was we went up to the cathedral, and I was thinking that, you know, Asa was talking about the Hereford World Map being up and people walking by it, and yet one of the things we did yesterday with our students was take them up to have a look and explore some of the spaces in the cathedral. And the Lincoln Cathedral actually has grotesques or these caricatures all over. And the choir entrance is beautiful. There are all these fluted kind of pillars. And at the bottom of each one, there's a little tiny figure. And there's a whole range of them. And so they were often used as protective devices or decorative devices that they may have had these other connotations, but they also could be there as just part of the space. And so this was what we were trying to do. And I think anybody who walks around the cathedral, you will see these all over, especially the pillars around the choir, but you'll see even our imp. He could be classified as a monster of types, right? I mean, he is an imp, he is a demon, he is a creature of this category. And yet we don't think of him in those negative ways unless you've been kind of run over by the hordes on the way to the football match or something. But it is that sense of he's a positive aspect of our culture and of our community. And as many of these decorative grotesques are in the cathedral, and we see them on manuscripts, and sometimes they're quite comical. And we looked at one yesterday that had racial overtones, most certainly, but at the same time, he was firing an arrow at the bum of... So it was this Ethiopian kind of fused figure with part Blemmyi, part kind of Ethiopian fused monster with bow and arrow shooting at a skiapod who was laying with his legs up in the air, but it's kind of directed right at his bum. So there's this kind of comical... We find it comical, right? So if anything, it gets you interested and gets you looking at the images, right. And then it can be a way into, well, yes, it's a lot of fun, but now let's talk about the more serious things. So I think it's almost like the gateway drug, right? Monsters are the gateway drug of the Middle Ages, right? If they can get you hooked and get you thinking about it, intrigue you enough to then do that deeper digging.
And I would also say that, yeah, there's a lot of darkness in a lot of this, but...
Monsters, by their nature, are sort of rule-breaking things. And so while they're often used to demonize, in their rejection of all of the normative categories, they also offer a great deal of possibility. So you can look at them from one side or the other. Why are they so popular if they're so awful, awful, awful? If they're such terrible, terrible examples to us, why is John Mandeville so popular? And the answer is much more popular than Chaucer, more popular than Beowulf, more popular than, as far as we can tell, all the other secular texts. Because they're fascinating and gripping and compelling and wondrous. I mean, the term monster is not really used much in medieval texts. What they tend to call such beings are wonders and marvels. And the key to those are that they are defined by the emotions they evoke in us rather than by some property inhering within the being. A monster is a thing, right? But wonder is something we feel when we see something. And wonder is not the same thing as horror at all. Some may be horrifying, but a lot are absolutely wondrous.
And if I can just add to that, I mean, not all monsters have negative connotations. I mean, you often see, especially in medieval imagery concerning the Trinity, right? Monstrosity can actually be used to represent that which is unknown to us because it's incomprehensible, that it is a part of the divine world. So you might have a three-headed Trinity, a single human body with three heads on it, much like a Cerberus. Or you have saints' lives where the monstrosity and the of the saint's body and what's been done to it is a way of expressing faith and devotion that is incomprehensible. It's in the power of the divine to heal or to resurrect. I mean, the story of Saint Hugh that appears in Chaucer's version of this blood libel legend. There's a young boy, and he is the Virgin intercedes and. He's undead dead. I mean, he's dead, but he's singing, and that's how they find him. And so he's basically a medieval zombie, but it is meant to show the power of God and the Virgin's intercession to save him and have him found so that he can have a proper Christian burial and have his soul depart from his body and go to heaven. So it has a very positive, in that sense, his monstrosity is very positive.
So I think we have... we've run out of time for any more questions. It's a funny thing about these shows. I always wonder if we'll run out of things to say, and every time we record one, I find that all my wonderful colleagues have got so many interesting things and important things to talk about that we amply fill the time. So I'd like to thank all three of my guests today, especially Professor Asa Mittman, all the way from California, and also Renee Ward and Andy Elliott from here at Lincoln. Also, as ever, Alex Lefchuk for keeping us on the road technically and sorting out the music. And thank you for listening. And Past Prologue will be back in about a month's time.
And it's all just a little bit of history repeating. Newspapers shout, a new style.